Music from Steve Bell on a Broken Road Radio Tuesday. Heard from Mary Catherine and Mighty Wind, and we heard, got a few laughs from Ken Davis and Lighten Up. 13 and a half minutes now after the hour, and on the line with us, Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, coming to us from Garden Valley, Texas, down there in... Are you in the high heat zone, Don? I was just reading temperature forecasts for the Southwest, and we're looking at 122 in Phoenix today. That could be an all-time record for Phoenix. Are you bearing up okay down there?
Oh, we have overcast skies, actually. Oh, so
you're protected.
It's not bad yeah. Here. We had some rain yesterday. But it looks like we got overcast skies, maybe turning to clear, but temperatures aren't nearly that hot here.
Okay, well, you got the first day of summer tomorrow, just after midnight. That's Eastern time, so you're on Central time, so about 11:30 tonight, it will turn to summer. You will hear a long drum roll, and then fireworks, and then summer will start. And you should look forward to that. Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, we'll see. It does get hot here, so but usually, I mean, in the hundreds in July, maybe August, mm-hmm. September, October, depending on what the rest of the country is doing and the temperatures. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's I think the highest it's gotten in the last couple of weeks has been 90.
Of course, Don is just east of Dallas there. Now, that's you're not as humid as say Houston would be, are you?
Oh, no. Yeah. Not at all. I mean, we are humid at the moment because we've had rain, but nowhere near Houston or Louisiana.
Okay. Well, that's good. Don, by the way, biochemist and I mentioned member of the Board of Creation Moments, and we talk with Don just about every Tuesday morning. Topics like, creation, evolution, faith, science, and how they should agree, but often don't. And today is one of those particular cases. We're dealing with an article from the Institute of Creation Research, and it's entitled Cherry-Picked Age for Key Evolutionary Fossil. Don, is it Homo naledi? Is that how you pronounce that? Am I close?
I would say naledid.
Naledi. Okay. All right.
Naledi.
Naledi.
Or something like
that. N-A-L-E-D-I. Well, you're the scientist. We'll go with your pronunciation then.
I'm not sure that's correct, but that's kind of how I hear it in my mind.
Now, we've talked about this creature before. They found a bunch of skeletons, now these were bones, I think, not fossils. And a lot of times in these articles, they confuse me. But I don't know whether they're talking about actual bones or fossils or if it could be the same thing. But supposedly, all these skeletons found down in the Rising Star Cave System in South Africa, they were hopeful that this might have been the missing link, which they've never yet found. And so they were kind of hoping that these would date to 3 or so million years old. And it didn't turn out that way, did it?
Oh, no, not at all. This particular sample that they're dating is actually in the Rising Star Cave in system. I guess it's a big system, which we did talk about before, in South Africa. And they were, as you said, they were hoping to date it to, at least 3 million years. And they used a bunch of dating techniques. They used, because they had bone and they had teeth, the surrounding structure or the surrounding cave had plenty of flowstone. And what is flowstone? Well, that's just basically calcium carbonate type deposits that water goes over it and it dissolves some of the calcium in the mineral in the surrounding rock and it flows.
That like limestone or sandstone, or do those qualify?
It's limestone deposits. Mm-hmm. Where do limestone deposits come from? Well, they're the shells of sea creatures. So, mm-hmm. lo and behold, this tells an interesting story because you've got in this cave a skeleton, at least a skull that they found. And we'll talk more about where it was found in a little bit. But they use various techniques to try to get a date of the skull. And so they used radiocarbon dating on the bone. They used electron spin resonance, ESR. They used uranium thorium decay, optical stimulated luminescence, also OSL.
As a layman, I'm amazed that there's so many different ways of dating things, because I think of carbon dating or radio. I don't know what all the names for that are, but that's only good back, a few tens of thousands of years, isn't it?
That's good to about 50,000 years. Mm-hmm. The uranium thorium is good to about 500,000 years.
Oh.
And these other techniques where you try to stimulate electrons for the electron spin, for example, you're looking at unpaired electrons in your sample and then trying to measure, you know, the relative amount of unpaired electrons. So these various techniques, try to come up with a date, and they all been in quote, calibrated to some degree. But after all is said and done, and looking at teeth and looking at bone and looking at the flowstone and various areas, they came up with dates scattered all over the place.
Hmm.
Leaving gaps in the date up to 800,000 years. So the uranium thorium date ranged from 546,000 to 560,000 years. OSL was 353 years. The radiocarbon dating, let's see, what did they say? Oh, 33 years. 33,000
years.
33,000, yeah. How do you choose? And some of the other uranium thorium gave 43,500 to 46,000 years. Mm-hmm. Notice that they give a range for each of these, but this range, it doesn't quite overlap with any of the other techniques.
No, so we're looking at anywhere from 33,000 to 849,000 sounds.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so that's quite a range.
What's a scientist to do here? It's like being dealt a hand of cards. Pick one, huh?
Right, and so you're going to try to pick where you have at least some agreement, but the problem with all these dating techniques, with this particular method, was that you have nothing. None of the dating techniques agreed. So you can't say, well, gee, I'll pick the three out of the, three out of the five, three out of the six that come close to each other, and then average those.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that in this case, so you can't say that, oh, gee, my dating of the flowstone, for example, matches my date on the bone. And so therefore, yeah, this guy must have died or gal must have died sometime, around that particular age. And so they kind of arbitrarily said, well, I don't know if they averaged the numbers or what, but they said, okay, the date for this this specimen is 236 to 335,000 years, which in itself is a pretty big range, but the actual data is as we said at the beginning, much broader than that.
Well, there's really no standard for this. If a bunch of people synchronize watches, there's one watch you pick. You say, okay, we'll all adjust the time to that. That's like a standard so that you're all together on the same page. But if you're talking about various dating methods, you can't, with any certainty, pick an object or a planet or a star and say, okay, we know this is 50,000 years old. Let's run all these dating systems on it and see if they agree, and then throw out the ones that don't. But because there's no such standard, is there, when you're dating things this old?
Well, there isn't. And then the other thing that you don't know is the environment itself. You hope the environment is stable, but if the environment is not stable, then you know, you can have leaching of various minerals that you're trying to date. The uranium-thorium technique, which is used for teeth and that type of stuff. The thorium itself is a radioactive compound, so it further degrades. Uranium ultimately degrades to lead, but when you pick an intermediate degradation, you know, product, then it's going away because it degrades, and it's kind of like a moving target.
So what what you're saying then, if I'm understanding this, is that scientists have to assume kind of a constant state. In other words, all things were then as they are now, and so we can apply these dating methods because, well, we have to assume that, don't we?
Well, they start off assuming that, and you can probably throw out some data based on, this sample was found in this environment, so therefore this particular dating method might not be accurate because we've got leaching or we've got contamination from mm-hmm. the surrounding environment. There is no discussion as to whether or not that took place in this for this sample. And exactly how the sample was found, but it was obviously in a cave that it was, let's say, had to have water in it in the past, and probably, you know, may even still have some leakage of some water.
Now, when you call this flowstone, so it's apparent that the rock wasn't translocated. It wasn't moved there by an earthquake or by some other means, but it existed there in water.
Well, water has to be involved for the calcite crystals basically to move. Mm-hmm. So it's much like a limestone cave that you would find the stalactites and stalagmites in. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same process. The stalactites and the stalagmites are forming because you've got some leakage of water, maybe from the surface, that percolates down. Now, it's not flowing at the, you know, okay. necessarily, but it's, you know, you got one drop of water that picks up some minerals from the cave surface and then starts dripping on a particular, location.
So this site was not necessarily under an ocean at one time.
Well, it probably was. Okay. I mean, of course, the creation model would say it was under underwater, and the cave may have formed, you know, as a result of water, or the cave was there with water in it, and this was one of those reservoirs, if you will, from the water from the deep, somehow this poor creature wound up in the cave, or the cave formed around them, and got kind of trapped in the cave, you know, and thereby had the demise. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that, you know, the creature got trapped, you know, there during the flood, you know, so... The actual age of the death of this particular individual is probably more like 4,000 years ago or 4,500, you know.
Well, you might say life and death. I mean, you've such a broad range of ages. You don't know when he died.
Exactly.
How does the dating suggest when he died? We know he's dead, but could he not have died? Lived and died. I mean, a lifespan of 20, 30, 40 years, and you're talking about a range of 200 to 250,000 years. How do we know? What makes us think that we know when this creature died as opposed to when he lived?
Yes.
You can't be that specific. Okay, all right, gotcha. Gotcha.
We don't. I mean, that's the problem, and you don't know what the age of the cave is. You don't know, and that's why they were dating the flowstone, to get an idea as to, you know, what the age of the cave mm-hmm. you know, might be, or the surrounding area, because oftentimes with radio dating or with dating techniques, you look and see, okay, this particular sample came from this area. How old is the area? Mm-hmm. Of course, the problem with all of this is that you're ignoring, again, as we've talked about in the past, you're ignoring history. And you're saying, I don't want to know history. I don't want to know anything about the earth or, you know, before. I don't want to know about a catastrophe that could have happened to the earth. I'm just going to assume that I can get all of the information that I need just from sampling, in this case, either the skull or the teeth, or the surrounding area. Now, of course, the problem when you do that, when you ignore history, is that you're ignoring a big part of the data, or at least an explanation as to how that individual happened to be located where it was located. Paleontologists at least, try to figure out a culture and what the culture was doing or a group of people were doing. When that particular culture might have passed away, but in this particular technique, I mean, they're not using anything, to help them pinpoint as to, what the age or why this particular sample was there at all. So the most likely explanation, given the historical record, is that this individual probably got trapped in the cave, or maybe even took refuge in the cave during the flood. And then, of course, as the waters rose, that cave certainly would have been flooded. And you wouldn't have found, in that case, you wouldn't have found a complete skeleton. You might, you would find bones and pieces just kind of scattered all about. And I think, as I recall from our previous discussion, that these bones weren't, a nice, neat burial form where you had the complete skeleton just laid out.
There are many individuals all dumped together.
All dumped together, yeah. Which, kind of screams catastrophe.
Yeah, it kind of does.
As opposed to this is going to be a burial site and you're just laying people down,
Mm-hmm.
History and history as recorded in particular in Genesis in this case, is a very important factor in understanding where this individual came from. Now, you still have the question, is this an ape or is this a man? Now, they're calling it a Homo naledi. That is, they've given a different species. Same genesis, Homo, meaning, it's the same genesis as man. But we're going to say they're trying to say, and trying to imply by just naming the fossil or the bones, trying to imply that this is a precursor to man, thus imposing their preconceived notion that man evolved.
Well, there's the other flaw. That and choosing the oldest possible date from all these various dating methods and say, well, it must be the oldest one because evolution must be true. There's a logical flaw here, and this has to do a little bit with the scientific method, so maybe you could explain this to me. If evolution is a valid theory, then science normally would be looking to disprove it, that is, to challenge it. But in this case, and in so many other cases we've talked about, the assumption is evolution is true, and they're still looking for proof. That doesn't make sense to me.
Right, and they're trying to, whatever finds we have, we're still looking. Mm-hmm. We can't find it, but we're still looking for that missing link.
Mm-hmm.
That link between the apes and humans. Now, you can go to natural history museums and see drawings of, the ape-like upright creature kind of morphing, if you will, into man. And that's the story that they're trying to portray or trying to tell or trying to find evidence with. Now, the problem is they haven't found anything So you've got the ape on one end, you've got man on the other end, and there's nothing in between. But, you know, we find a skull that maybe looks a little apish, and we automatically assume that, and it maybe has some characteristics of a human skull, and we automatically assume that it is somewhere in between. And that may not indeed be the case at all.
Well, what is then the strongest evidence that evolution is true? I mean, what is there that says this is the way things are, and we just need to proceed on that assumption, that basis, that knowledge, that somehow evolution, I don't know, whatever qualifies a law, but theory rather than hypothesis or just wild guess?
Well, I mean, it is a guess. It is a guess based on the assumption that there was no divine intervention into all the stuff that we see around us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the more you look, the more evidence you find to disprove that. I mean, everything that we see around us screams design and screams an intelligent, you know, being had to put this together. Even the location of Earth, as we talked about before, the location of Jupiter, the location of Mars, mm-hmm. you know, the Sun, and where the Sun is in our particular galaxy.
We learned that it all works together as a system that enables life here on this planet.
Right. And then if you go the opposite direction and you start, you know, delving into the, you know, the human body or even biology at all, you find that, hey, you know, this is remarkable. This is, you know, life is so complex. And there's, you know, there's so, yes, okay, you've got similar proteins in various, you know, creatures and organisms. Yes, okay, they're similar. And so that maybe you've got some similar DNA. But just because you've got, you know, similar structures doesn't mean that it's the same thing. And so that's what they, you know, the evolutionists who will say, oh, you see, similar, so therefore it had to be evolved, you know, it had to evolve.
The thing
so
there is one of proportion, because scientists look at, say, a 1 or 2% difference in the DNA from two creatures and say, they must be linked, they must be related somehow, they must be together because they're so close in DNA, and yet that 1 or 2% difference is in fact a huge difference in the nature of the two creatures, like from mouse to man is like a 2 or 3% change in the DNA, as I understand it.
Well, even that's incorrect, because yeah. the way those studies were done were, let's find all the similar DNA, and then let's match the similar DNA between the two and see how different they are.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you're pre picking the DNA. You're not looking at all of the DNA. If you looked at all the DNA, you'd find out that, oh, gee whiz, this is only 40% similar, or a 60%, you know, similar, which is the actual case when they looked at the monkey and the humans, and not the 2 to 3 or the, you know, 5% difference. The major, you know, differences in the biology actually come from not those portions of the DNA that code for proteins, but those portions of the DNA that don't code, which, you know, seemingly don't code for anything. But we've learned in the past, you know, 20, 30, 50 years that, oh, gee, this is all about control. So, you know, we've got control upon control upon control in the biological systems that is dictating what is being manufactured at any particular, you know, point in time that determines that, you know, this particular body is, you know, what it is and functioning the way it's functioning, all because of this very complex control mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't even look at something like as simple as bleeding. and the cascade that is required, at least 30 different enzymes and proteins that's required to clot a cut, mm-hmm. for example. So when you cut yourself, you know, blood starts oozing, which is a good thing. So you want the blood to flow to flush out the bacteria or to flush out any, you know, impurities in that cut. So you want it to flow for a period of time. That's a good thing. But, you know, obviously if it just kept flowing, you would die because you would have no more blood.
Yeah.
So you want it after a controlled period of time to start getting thick. And so it does. And this elaborate cross cross-linking, you know, network gets set up, and you know, pretty soon, in most people, unless you have hemophilia, you know, the blood clot—I mean, the blood clots—forms a gel and stops bleeding. Mm-hmm. And now you've got a protective coating over that cut, a natural protective coating over that cut, that also helps prevent, you know, microorganisms from getting into your blood system. So how do you explain that? Oh, that just happened by chance. Well, I don't think so. I mean, because it's all intricately controlled. And that's just one little example of, you know, biology. And then if you go deeper into, you know, the molecules of matter, for example, the electrons and the neutrons and the protons and the atoms themselves and the subatomic particles that they're made of, everything must be in balance. So the electromagnetic forces must be just exactly where they are. The strong nuclear forces and the weak nuclear forces have to be exactly where they are. If they weren't, you wouldn't have any matter whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't even have the building blocks of the universe if any of those proportions were out of proportion.
That certainly argues against pure chance, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But the whole evolutionary story, you know, starting with the Big Bang, suggests that, oh, this just happened and it makes for a good story and we don't need a creator, we don't need somebody that we're accountable to, and we can imagine how all of this came about. But in the end, everything that we look at just says there was a creator.
I like that. Well, it's true. I mean, if it argues for design, it necessarily, by the same logic, argues against pure chance, argues against accident, argues against evolution. There's a whole lot of scientific thinking and a whole lot of very bright minds that have produced substantial scientific evidence that evolution is not the case, that in fact that we have been made by a creator. You'll find a lot of it at creationmoments.com. That's their website. And you'll find their DVDs and blogs and books and lots of articles and information that is scientific in nature. And it never gets talked about. It's rarely exposed to people. And if you have an interest in this, knowing whether or not you were an accident or you were the creation of a loving God, you can check out some of that evidence at creationmoments.com. And by the way, there's a link in our chat window right now at brokenroadradio.com. You can check this article out that we've been discussing this morning with Dr. Don. It's an Institute of Creation Research article, icr.org. You can find a lot more interesting information there on the whole fact of creation. Don, thanks so much for your time this morning. It was good to talk to you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Yeah. And anytime you want to come down and help us with filling our bottles with wine, you're certainly welcome.
I would love to do that. 90 degrees, huh? that could sell me. Yeah, that could get me there. Don, take care. We'll see you next week.
Okay, you too.